Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners. Good to speak with you again.
Hey ho, everyone. This edition is one close to our hearts because
yeah, I hope it's not too dry.
I don't think so. It's the dry part is the National Bank of the United States, but the interesting part is that Hamilton and Jefferson were asked by the great George Washington, the first president, to write a memo each, along with two others, about whether a national bank was constitutional, whether the U.S. Constitution authorized Congress creating a National Bank of the United States. And Jefferson famously said, no, he's a strict constructionist. It's not enumerated in the Constitution.
And Hamilton said, yes. The government can create corporations. There's nothing wrong with that.
And Hamilton said, do you want to be a pitiful fourth-ranked nation that can only do what a bunch of guys who met in Philadelphia say it can do? Or do you want to be a great nation that's going to have to make some adjustments, and you don't want every time that you want an adjustment to have to go to the process of a constitutional amendment or a new constitutional convention? Come on, folks. We need some fundamental good sense and flexibility in this.
It was either you or Jefferson who brought up – I think it was Jefferson who brought up this complex – series of events that Hamilton wanted to.
He wanted three things. He wanted to assume the national debt and pay it off, including the state debts. That was number one. Number two, he wanted a national banking system, a national bank, to coordinate this, which makes a certain kind of sense. And number three, he wanted to. It's called mercantilism. He wanted to fund infant industry so the United States could begin to compete with Great Britain.
And that's what I thought was pretty interesting is, he wanted to create tax breaks for certain companies that they liked. And a lot of it sounds fairly modern.
It's what we do.
Yeah, we do. And we go back to this argument to find out the origins of it.
Well, Hamilton believed that we were going to be a great commercial world power with a strong military and a central government that was flexible enough to do all the things that it might possibly want to do, which is exactly what we've become. And Jefferson believed that we were a kind of unique in human history experiment in severely limited government, and it would be worth our while to try to be pure to that as long as we possibly could. As you like to say, he also doubled the size of the United States with an unconstitutional
purchase. Have a problem doing that one.
Well, nobody does. I mean, look, if someone came to you tonight and offered you the whole city block, you would say, of course.
Yes.
When the lottery comes to you in that way, you have to say yes, but it did compromise Jefferson's principles. And Frederick Jackson Turner, in his famous essay of 1893 called The Significance of the Frontier in American History, said, when Jefferson purchased Louisiana in 1803, he essentially killed the Republic because to administer that much territory was going to require much, 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 much more government than could ever have been contemplated by the Founding Fathers. It's one of the most important essays ever written in America. It's called The Significance of the Frontier in American History. We'll post it on our website. But what Turner said was, if you really wanted to be a republic, you didn't want to double your size in 1803. You already had too much land. But to do this, you really are now talking about what Jefferson called an empire. Jefferson's phrase was empire of liberty, but it's still an empire. And an empire, from Rome, we know that a republic is not an empire, and an empire cannot be a republic. And the minute you become an empire, you have to say farewell to a whole range of things you thought were important goods.
That is another conversation which I shall look forward to. Meanwhile, let's go to this week's show about the original questions.
All I can say is Jefferson was right, Hamilton was wrong, Hamilton won, Jefferson didn't. Thanks for listening.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me is President Thomas Jefferson. Good to see you, sir.
Good day to you, my dear citizen.
You're looking well, sir. I thank you again for a conversation this week.
I am always happy to talk about America. Monticello, good food, good wine, good gardens, our unique Republican form of government, and the possibilities that America will be the model to every country for the rest of time about what's at stake and how to do it right to preserve the maximum of human liberty with the minimum of government.
I thank you, sir. I feel so fortunate to be able to speak with you as a witness to history. You have helped me to understand my time, which is always my personal desire and goal in our conversations. I hope that's all right.
I hope that it works for you because, as you know, I believe very strongly that the earth belongs to the living, and 40 years of experience in government is worth a century of reading. So I hope that whatever I happen to say about my own time and place is not simply antiquarian and has some limited utility for all of you who live in a time that I could never, under any circumstances, have contemplated.
Well, sir, we are limited as human beings. We don't have the ability to look forward, to learn, but we do have the ability to look back. And from that standpoint, sir, you do help me understand.
Well, we were 6 million people basically hugging the Atlantic shore, still psychologically pretty enslaved to British habits, not yet bold enough to create our own literature or our own art or really even our own social structure. We were a derivative culture derived from Europe, particularly from England and particularly Protestant England. And we wanted very much to create a unique American republic. But we couldn't help but hearken back to models that we had known growing up and models that we had read about in the annals of British and European history. So there's probably more continuity than there is breach in the American experiment. But I was one of those, and there were a number of us who wanted to break with the old world as much as we possibly could. And even once, I agreed with Noah Webster, the kind of Federalist crackpot, who was also the author of An American Dictionary. But Webster, early in his life, was something of a radical, and he believed that we probably would never get out from under England as long as we shared a language with them. And so there were some, I suppose you'd say, whimsical proposals early after the Revolution that we would change the official language of the United States, possibly to ancient Greek. And if we did that, our break with England would be fundamental, and we would inevitably have to pursue a very different path because we would no longer share a language with the mother country. But as you know, that was a pretty big fantasy.
Yes, sir, and I can't imagine the public outcry of...
Well, once you get over the transition period, it's not so difficult.
Yeah, that transition period could be a great deal to get over.
I also proposed that we adopt a decimal metric system, and I made it clear at the time that, yes, it will be hard to get out from under pounds and shillings and pence and tuppence and guineas and also out from under the foot and the yard and the mile and so on. But I said once we make the transition, people will grow up with no other background, and they will simply accept a decimal metric system. I was able to accomplish that in our coinage, dime, dollar, $10, $100, $1,000, but I wasn't able to accomplish that with our metric system, our system of measuring distances.
That argument goes on to this day, but you lead me into something, sir, and as I have the rich opportunity to speak with you about your period of history and learn more about it, you know, I'm always digging farther back. I've been searching for what I might refer to as the original argument, and I think I may have found it. You'll forgive me. I'm not as well versed on this as you, sir, but maybe you can help me. I go back to a time in 1791 when Mr. Hamilton was calling for the creation of a national bank, and you were one of President Washington's ministers. And Mr. Washington asked his four ministers to write, I guess what you would call a brief or an argument about why we should have a national bank or why we should not. Am I doing all right so far, sir?
Yes, I would say that there are a couple of fundamental questions in America, and one of them is, are we a nation of states, kind of a confederation of states like Maryland and Virginia and Georgia, or are we a nation state with smaller units called the state of Virginia, the state of New Hampshire, the state of New York, the state of Pennsylvania? I was for the first, for a confederacy of semi-sovereign states, but what prevailed was centralized nation state in which the states had been reduced to something like administrative units. I preferred the Articles of Confederation, frankly, to the new Constitution of the United States. So that was one of the big debates, one of the great questions that we had to settle. And then another one was once, and as you know, I was not one of the authors of the Constitution of 1787. I was in Europe at the time. I played no role except that of bibliographer, perhaps, to that process. And I had to watch from a very long distance away and respecting the secrecy rule that they had adopted. There was very little that I could learn until the Constitution was completely finished. But once we had a Constitution, once it was ratified by the individual states and became the social contract of the United States, then the question was, are we going to adhere narrowly, literally, punctiliously to this instrument and do only those things which the Constitution enumerated to make sure that it is not an enabling document, but a constraining document? Or are we going to read the Constitution as a flexible, lively platform that can be stretched into new configurations to meet exigencies that could not have been anticipated at the Constitutional Convention and to allow it to grow with the country? And that's a very, very important debate, conversation, and it involves the creation of the National Bank of the United States. So
exactly, sir, and that's why I was hoping to speak with you about that, because I find these written arguments between you and Mr. Hamilton fascinating.
I, as you know, believe that the Articles of Confederation were superior to the Constitution that was drafted in 1787. But I accepted the fact that a new Constitution had been written, and it indeed was ratified by the individual states. And so it was what you would call the law of the land or the fundamental charter of the United States. So then the question becomes, now what? What is permissible under the Constitution and what is beyond the boundaries of the new Constitution?
And this was a large, large issue, a very heavy argument. And my understanding, help me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was that initially President Washington was, we would say, on the fence. He had not made up his mind one way or the other. Is that correct?
That is correct. So here's what happened. This Hamilton, who was a war hero and had been the aide-de-camp to George Washington and was, frankly, like a son to him, was appointed by the new president, George Washington, to be the first Secretary of the Treasury. And Hamilton was a gifted financier. He had read all of the most important texts from England and from France about the nature of public finance. He was something of a fiscal genius. And he decided, first of all, that we could never be a credible country unless we paid off the national debt that had been created during the Revolution. We, of course, had gone deeply into debt to secure our liberty. And so this ran to a very large sum. There were two types of debt. There were state debts, you know, Virginia's debt and Delaware's debt and New York's debt.
You should mention, sir, in passing, that Virginia was a state that mastered its debt.
We had paid off our debt.
And many of the smaller states had not.
Some states had paid and some hadn't. But there was, whatever the case, there were 13 states and there was a range of state indebtedness. And it would have been easy enough for Hamilton to say that's a Pennsylvania issue, that's a Virginia issue, that's a South Carolina issue. But he said, no, we're not only going to pay off the national debt, the bona fide national debt that was undertaken by the Confederation Congress, but we're also going to absorb all of the state debts and put them into one large lump, and we'll pay off all of it, not instantly, but over time. And in doing so, we'll put the United States on a firm footing fiscally, and will gain credit in the world's banks and markets. This will have a wonderful effect. And I have to say, I on the whole, I agree with Hamilton that the assumption of all the state debts and the paying off of the national debt were a good idea.
At face value, it's an argument that holds merit.
But here's what bothered me. One is that Virginia had paid off its debt, so in effect we were paying the debt twice, and other states hadn't bothered, and so we were subsidizing their fiscal irresponsibility.
Perhaps they weren't able, sir.
Well, either way, but nevertheless, it was in a certain sense taxing the more responsible states twice. And secondly, this perhaps diverts us too much from our topic, but the states had managed to survive and wage war, and the nation had managed to survive and wage war by issuing paper certificates, and they had depreciated, so they were worth 20 cents on the dollar or 5 cents on the dollar or 50 cents on the dollar. And Hamilton told his friends that he planned to redeem them at par before he told the people of the United States. So his friends went out and bought up this depreciated specie, all these depreciated bonds at 5 cents or 20 cents on the dollar, knowing that in a week or two he would announce that they were going to be paid off at 100%. When I saw that, I realized that Hamilton wasn't a fiscal genius. He was a corruptionist who was determined to put money in the pockets of his cronies. And that's really where I began to doubt Colonel Alexander Hamilton.
Mr. Jefferson, we need to take a short break. But when we return, there is a written history here, papers written by you and Mr. Hamilton, arguing for and against the constitutionality of a Bank of the United States. And when we return, I'd like to get into some of the specifics about that, if it would be all right with you, sir.
This is the most important early debate in American history, and so it's something that I would be very pleased to try to explain.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jefferson. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And this week, President Jefferson has been good enough to agree to talk to us about one of the original arguments, the constitutionality of a national bank. Welcome back, Mr. Jefferson.
I'm glad to be here. You know, the first question was, shall the national government pay off the national debt and assume the state debts? And once we had cleared that question, there was this very large figure, the national debt of the United States, that had to be paid. And we knew we couldn't pay it overnight, that we would have to figure out how to use that money to leverage funds to run the routine operations of government and have what's called a sinking fund to pay it off. And we had to determine how soon we would pay it off and so on. And when Hamilton looked at this, and again, I will acknowledge that Hamilton was a financial genius. When he looked at it, he realized that he really would be able to do it better if he had a central banking system. In a sense, a national bank of the United States where he could—
Oh, Mr. Jefferson, don't you think that was his plan all along?
I don't know, but I was shocked when he suddenly came forward with this because he had been at the Constitutional Convention. He was a delegate from New York, and he could have proposed this as early as 1787 and did not.
I think you're being too kind. It looks to me like a straight line between assumption and a national bank. One could not exist without the other.
Well, we actually wound up, after my time, killing off the national bank and using state banks instead. So I always thought that state banks or private banks would be sufficient for this, but Hamilton did not. And let's just grant that for the moment. I'm not a friend of banks. I don't like the idea of a national bank. I don't like the national government having that much fiscal power over laborers and farmers and mechanics and sailors and so on. But let's just grant that for the moment, that Hamilton decided he wanted a national bank. That was the basis of this. And the question then became, is a national bank constitutional? Did the founding fathers, when they met in Philadelphia and enumerated the powers of the Congress or the United States government, did they contemplate a national bank? If they did, we'd find it. They said you can coin money, you can contract alliances, you can wage war, you can levy troops, you can settle disputes between individual states. The Constitution enumerates, that is, spells out point by point, a whole series of powers. They're called enumerated powers. And the question then is, when you look at the Constitution, is a national bank something that the Founding Fathers enshrined by way of an enumerated article or sentence? If it's there, then it's the easiest thing in the world. Just as you can coin money, if the national bank was planned by the, anticipated by the Founding Fathers, then nobody would have had a serious debate about this. But if it's not there, then what?
Yes, and we're lucky today to have the ability to look at the original arguments that both you and Mr. Hamilton made. To back up a bit, President Washington was on the fence, undecided about this, and he reached out to his four ministers and asked you all to present a written argument about this.
Indeed, I suppose you could say that he was on the fence. He was leaning towards no because he was a Virginia farmer like myself. We had largely antagonistic views of banking, and particularly central banking. We had seen that the Bank of England was helplessly in debt and the country was bankrupted by this. So if Washington had had to choose based upon his own hunch or his own intuition, he might have vetoed the bank bill. But he was unsure, and he knew that this was a critically important question with respect to our national finances and a critically important question with respect to future interpretation of the Constitution and the intentions of the Founding Fathers. So he asked each of us to present our arguments somewhat formally by writing a memo about it.
And you complied, and I have that document in front of me now. It's a concise document consisting of about 2,100 words. It goes through point by point your argument against this. And then I have Mr. Hamilton's opinion. And it would seem, sir, that President Washington shared your document with Mr. Hamilton.
Yes.
So Mr. Hamilton had the ability to go through and point by point address each one of your arguments. And incidentally, his argument is not concise. It's almost 13,000 words going through and refuting your arguments. That doesn't seem fair, sir.
It's not fair because in a formal debate, one person speaks first, the second person replies, then there's a rebuttal, then there's a response. I never got a chance to rebut Colonel Hamilton's immensely long memo about this subject, but he had the advantage of seeing what I had written. On the other hand, he's fighting for his life. If he said if the national debt had not been paid off and the assumption bill had failed, he would have felt the need to resign and return to private life. He felt the same way about the bank. He had a three-point program. First, you consolidate the national debt. Secondly, you create central banking to administer that work. And third, he wanted funds, government funds, to be used to create model industrial communities like Paterson, New Jersey, where government would provide seed money so that we could build infant industries in the United States that could compete with those in England. So this was his larger dream of the economy, and he felt that if any one of these collapsed or failed to get congressional or presidential approval, that the whole system would fail to work in the way that it needed to. So for Hamilton, this is not an academic point. This is really about his whole purpose as a financier and his vision of this country and frankly, his vision of the United States Constitution. But as you say, there's something a little bit unfair about the process. But I have to say, I got a chance to say exactly what I meant. I laid out my position. I think it's very clear. I will tell you this. I think that it's the right position and that George Washington made a historic mistake in refusing to veto the bank bill.
It would be difficult to go that far back in time and sort of course creatively how the United States would have developed had this been not approved. But I must go to Mr. Hamilton's paper, sir. In the very beginning of it, he writes something that will resonate with contemporary Americans. He says, "In entering upon the argument, it ought to be premised that the objections of the Secretary of State and Attorney General are founded on a general denial of the authority of the United States to erect corporations." That was your argument. What's your response to that?
Well, it's in a sense my argument. I'm not as concerned about corporations as I am about constitutional interpretation. So let me try to lay out my view of this as simply as possible. The founding fathers met. They brainstormed, to use a term from your time, you know, what are the powers of the Supreme Court? What are the powers of the president? What are the powers of the Congress? How are powers different in the House and in the Senate, et cetera? And they debated this, and they made lists. Government can coin money. Government can wage war. Government can levy taxes, et cetera. Government can enter into treaties. They brainstormed and thought, what does a government do, and what do we want our government, since it's a republican form and not a monarchy or a plutocracy or an aristocracy, what do we want our limited government to do? And they laid all this out by way of enumerated powers. If they had intended a national bank or central banking for the United States, they would have made that one of the powers of government. They did not.
Well, that's one of the arguments that Mr. Hamilton makes as you go through this rather lengthy document. He is, and again, that's the question I would ask you, is it would seem to me that Mr. Hamilton is doing his own boutique version of the Constitution. In other words, he's changing the interpretation of the Constitution to further his own desires.
That's precisely so. So let's just say that a national bank is a good idea, and let's just say that it was essential for putting the United States on a firm economic footing and building our fiscal credibility in the world's arena. Granting that, which, by the way, I do not, the question then becomes, is the Constitution favorable to such an idea? Does it authorize this sort of thing? And when you look at the Constitution and all of its enumerated powers, you immediately realize they didn't enumerate this power. They did not say you may at some point want to do central banking, and if you do, that's a power that you have. They were silent on this question, and silence means no. So let's say that we all think we can agree there's a national consensus bordering on unanimity that we need a national bank, but the Constitution has not authorized one. Then the remedy, my friend, is to go back to the Constitution and amend it and to say to the people, look, when we wrote this in 1787, we couldn't know everything. We didn't anticipate that we would need a national bank, but now we see that we do, but we realize that that wasn't authorized and it wasn't enumerated and it wasn't ratified, and therefore we can't just presume that we're going to do this because it's a good idea. We're going to go back to you, the sovereign. We're going to propose this amendment. It's a simple amendment that says the government of the United States shall be empowered to create a national banking system. You either ratify that amendment or you don't. And if you don't, we'll have to get by as best we can. We think you will because you're flexible and you understand the way that things change and conditions require new responses to social and political questions. But we are going to put it to you, the sovereign, because you ratified a certain instrument. We're now asking for something that is clearly not enumerated or anticipated by the Constitution. And therefore, when we do that, our only responsible remedy is to go back to the people, go back to the sovereign and say, we wish we had thought of this before. We did not. Now that we think we need this, we must put ourselves into your hands, and you, the sovereign, must decide if you want to amend the Constitution to enable this proposal. And if you do, thank you. If you don't, we respect you, and we will find another way.
There are those to this day, sir, who would be called strict constitutionalists.
That's what I am, a strict and literal constructionist.
Understood. I'm wondering if you could explain to our listeners, sir, why being a strict constitutionalist is so important. How does it change government? How does it change our lives? Why is it so important to follow that path?
Because that's the only way the people maintain control of a government which is an expression of their own public will.
So you think it's a protection?
Of course. I said it in my memo that to take a single step beyond the powers thus deliberately drawn around the powers of government is to enter a field of boundless abuse no longer susceptible of any definition. So today it's a national bank. Next year it's a National Science Foundation. A year later it's a redistribution of money to every citizen in the United States. Once you open that door to broad construction and say, well, the founding fathers couldn't know everything, and we've changed our minds, but look, we don't want to be stuck with their limitations, and so we're just going to do whatever it is that we think is useful, then you may as well not have a constitution. Then you may as well have written your constitution on wax, and you can just stretch it into any shape that happens to please you from moment to moment. Our very liberty and our very security is in having this written constitution that says, here are the things that we have authorized government to do, and things that we have not authorized government to do are clearly things it should not do unless it returns to us and asks for more power. If five of us lived on an island and we pooled our money and we said, well, what kind of social compact do we want? And we said, well, we probably need a court system, so let's use some of our money for that. And we probably need a perimeter fence, so let's use some of our money for that. And we probably need a Coast Guard. And so we enumerate these powers and then we sign that. We say we've all agreed. Some of these were hard-fought decisions and there were compromises and nobody got exactly what he wanted. But the five of us have come to an agreement and we have ratified this instrument, and it now tells us what we can do. Well, maybe 3 weeks later, Mr. Hamilton comes along and says, I want to build the Tower of Babel. I want to use public funds for it. It seems like a really great idea to me. I'm just going to do it. I know it wasn't authorized by you five, but you know what? I just think I'd like to do this. And so even though you explicitly said those things you wanted to fund and those things that you didn't, I'm just going to assume that it's okay with you if I start inventing new functions for government.
All right. I understand.
Do you? Because if you do, you're on my side.
I am, sir, and I do. Humorous as that might have been.
It's not meant to be humorous. It means that government is my agent. And when I create an instrument, a social compact, I have authorized it to do certain things.
Mr. Jefferson, really, recreate the Tower of Babel. Moving on from that, Mr. Hamilton uses the word sovereign a lot in his arguments. It's almost as if he believes that a sovereign nation, a sovereign power, has the power to change the Constitution, do whatever it thinks is right.
Well, here's how he based his metaphysics. He said, look, we're going to have to be flexible. The founding fathers, however great they were, could not have anticipated all the things that are going to be necessary. And do we want to be some sort of straitjacketed nation that can't really do anything because it has it's created such severe limitations on public action that we wind up being a fourth or fifth or sixth rank power? He said, really? Do we want to do that? Maybe that's punctiliously tied to the social compact, and maybe in some utopian world we want that kind of constraining mechanism on government. But if you do that, you'll be pitiful and you'll be poor and you'll be set upon by the sharks and the tigers of the world. And so he said, we probably don't want that. And he said, if you're really looking for language in the Constitution, if you're looking for authorizing language for the bank, you won't find it enumerated. I will acknowledge that. But he said there are two clauses in the Constitution that in a sense can be seen to authorize it. And one is from the famous preamble, the General Welfare Clause. So in the famous preamble that was written by Gouverneur Morris in the Constitution, it says to promote the general welfare. And Hamilton said, look, there's your national bank. It's contemplated, it's embraced by the General Welfare Clause. And then he said, well, I know some of you might not quite see it there, a national bank under the phrase general welfare, but if you missed it, then go to the end of the Constitution. And at the very end, it says government is empowered to do those things that are necessary and proper to fulfill the other enumerated powers in this instrument. So there's some flexibility there. It says that what basically the necessary and proper clause at the end of the Constitution means is that obviously we can't anticipate absolutely everything.
But you didn't buy that argument.
No, sir, I did not. And here's why. It's not clear to me that a national bank is necessary or proper to fulfill other desiderata of the Constitution. So I'm not accepting the argument that this is a necessary and proper extension of already enumerated powers. That's number one. And secondly, and here really I ask you, and I don't mean it as a rhetorical question, if you can see a national bank embraced under the General Welfare Clause, what can't be embraced there? There's nothing that can't then be authorized if you can read the General Welfare Clause with that much elasticity, and if the necessary and proper clause is read to authorize a national bank, which clearly is not enumerated in the Constitution, then what can't be authorized under the necessary and proper clause? And so my point, sir, is why, and I mean this, and I don't mean this as a talking point or rhetoric, I mean this as a genuine argument. What's the point of having a written Constitution if you can read the necessary and proper and general welfare clauses with such latitudinarian flexibility that there is nothing that couldn't be contemplated?
In your argument towards the end, sir, you talk about the Constitution is not being intended for a shade of or two of convenience.
I saw the Constitution as a restraining document and assumed that, yes, we would, of course, need to make adjustments over time, but they would be made by way of either constitutional amendments or we would tear up the Constitution once every 19 or 20 years so that the next generation can bring in the things that it felt were missing in the previous generation's enumeration of the proper role of government.
Mr. Jefferson, I can't thank you enough for sharing these insights with us this week. I hope next time, sir, I will make it up to you and we'll pick a topic of conversation that's a bit more pleasant. Say books or wine
or gardens or friendship or anything except my quarrels with that colossus of the anti-Republican forces, Colonel Alexander Hamilton.
Noted, sir. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be joined by the gentleman who portrays President Thomas Jefferson, the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. This week, our weekly conversation was about Hamilton. And you know, President Jefferson didn't complain about it once. I was quite impressed.
This is a really, really important subject. We take this for granted. We should not. Jefferson was right, but it would have made it very difficult for the United States. Hamilton was wrong, but he made it possible for us to do extraordinary things in the world. But Jefferson was right about this.
If you open Hamilton's arguments and you read them beginning to end, it makes sense as long as you continue to follow his thought pattern. If you open them anywhere in the middle and just read a standout statement, it doesn't make any sense. Do you follow me?
I do.
So that's good argumentative writing. But at the same time, you know, open it up and it says, it is conceded that implied powers are to be considered as delegated equally with expressed ones. Then it follows that as a power of erecting a corporation may as well be implied as any other thing. If you don't get there from the beginning, you go, wait a minute, what? Does that make sense to you?
It does. But here's my question. Is the CIA constitutional? What's your answer?
As much as military is.
Okay. Is the National Endowment for the Arts constitutional?
No.
Why not?
Because it has never been granted the power by the Constitution to exist.
Is the Center for Disease Control constitutional?
Yes.
Because?
General Welfare Clause.
So you're doing what a responsible jurist would do. You're saying, look, I'm going to try to figure out if it's contemplated under some clause or other in the Constitution, and if it is, yeah, we could probably be a little flexible, but if it clearly isn't, then that's another matter.
Well, yeah, you say national endowment, and people could argue that that's general welfare, but it really isn't. It's beneficial to all citizens. I would certainly support it, but I don't see it as constitutional.
So Jefferson's point, and I think it's an extremely important one, whether you agree with it or not, is that You can't just do anything. If you're going to do anything, then what's the point? That the whole, we're talking about a historically unique experiment in limited government. We forget that because we have a gigantic government and a whopping national debt and bloated bureaucracy. By the way, that's why Donald Trump got resonance when he said he wanted to go address that and clear the swamp and reduce the bloatedness of all of this. People get that. But that's where we are. We have a gigantic national government. It does a whole range of things. Some of them are essential, like a War Department. Some of them are not essential. And it's just grown up this way. And what it's produced is a government that is out of control, wasteful, hidebound, and enormously expensive, so expensive that we can't pay for it. And so Jefferson's view was, wait a minute, it's not just about the national debt. It's about what sort of society you want to live in. And we're all used to this society, David. We like food stamps, and we like Social Security, and we like Medicare and Medicaid, and we like all the things that we have. I might like this set, you might like that set, but people like government, or government wouldn't do those things. But Jefferson's view is, wait a minute, we're not just a country. We were an experimental, limited republic, which was going to grant to the national government the tiniest number of absolutely essential things contemplatable. There would be more powers available in states and in local governments because they're closer to home. But in the national government, because this is a unique historical experiment in human liberty and limited government, we're going to bend over backwards to prevent the national government from creeping into larger and larger and larger and larger dimensions and extending itself into every possible aspect of people's lives. That some of these things may be desirable. A National Endowment for the Humanities, you bet. A Corporation for Public Broadcasting sounds great. Aid to Public Education, terrific. But that, for Jefferson, is not the nature of the American experiment. The experiment, and I use the term in a really technical way, the American experiment was about minimalism, that our national government was going to be minimalist and we were going to keep a lid on it and tightly control it.
You and I have had this conversation before. If Jefferson understood the importance of, let's say, a national library or a national museum, he would say, you know, I really like that idea. Pass an amendment.
Yes, he said that. So you and I have a very important example of this, David, because we're both lovers of Lewis and Clark. So when Lewis comes back, he brings back this immense treasury of bear necklaces and fur robes.
And had there been a national...
Had there been a Smithsonian, that those things would have been saved. And Jefferson said no. Charles Wilson Peale, the great museum innovator in Philadelphia and the person who wound up with a lot of the treasures of the Lewis and Clark expedition, wrote to Jefferson and said basically, well, don't you think that it's about time for us to have a national museum? And Jefferson, who loved this idea, I mean, of course you want you want the Smithsonian. Of course you want the National
but
Art Gallery.
But it wasn't constitutional.
But it wasn't there. And so yeah. Jefferson wrote back and said two things. He said, my friend, however desirable this is, we must first pay off the national debt. That's our moral duty. And secondly, let's assume we got that under control. Since it wasn't enumerated or contemplated, we have to go back to the people and get an amendment that authorizes this sort of thing. He also wanted a national university. He wanted national libraries, etc. But he said, no, however desirable these are, we can't just do them because they're good and desirable. We must find specific authorization in the social compact of the United States, and I don't see it, so I won't do it.
So what I came out of after this painful reading of all of these documents is, if we have anybody in history to blame for a bloated government, it's Alexander Hamilton. He led us down that path.
There's your musical on Broadway.
Yeah, well...
You know, so he's the guy who...
I need verification of that from the Jefferson scholar.
You are correct. So that probably broad construction was coming anyway. In other words, if Hamilton had never lived, we probably would have something like what we have, because there's a natural evolution of societies. And the thing that Jefferson and Madison and George Mason and others wanted was what would be called a chimera, a kind of a mythological utopia that probably, I mean, where would you turn? Where's the most limited government on earth? There isn't one. The nature of modern society with finance and drones and the internet and pharmaceuticals and airplanes and railroads and interstate commerce and international trade is such that probably this idea of this severely minimalist national government is probably a fiction. It's probably a fantasy. And so probably if Hamilton never lives, it comes out more or less the same.
Really? Do you think so?
Yes.
Huh.
But what Jefferson was saying was, do you or do you not want to try to do this? If you do want to try to create a limited republic, you have to be true to it. And so here's, I mean, think of it. You and I love Lewis and Clark. So what was lost? Because there was no National Museum, we lost a treasury of artifacts, Native American medicine bags, moccasins, bighorn sheep horns and skins, teepees, seeds, artifacts of a whole range of sorts. We lost this unbelievable treasury because there was no place to put it. Do you think Jefferson wanted a place to put this? Of course.
I'm not sure that's a fair argument, though, really, because from my reading of Jefferson, nothing surpassed his desire for America's future. And he would give up those things in order to ensure his argument.
He wanted them, but when push came to shove, he said, no, I can't do that. You've got to amend the Constitution. And if you're going to follow Hamilton's law of flexibility, he said, you may as well write the thing on wax.
And we have to think, too, you know, to me anyway, is it? I mean, nowadays you go, okay, constitutional amendment, well, let's get that going. If something as popular as that would easily pass. In Jefferson's time, a constitutional amendment was much more difficult, wasn't it?
Maybe, maybe not. But the thing is, it's too late. So, you know, you can't get rid of all this stuff. You'd have to put a constitutional amendment in saying this far and no farther. We'll embrace everything we now have and there's nothing that...
On the other hand, if we look at Jefferson historically, he went in an anti-federalist and he came out much more a federalist. He didn't have a problem bending the Constitution when it came to the Louisiana Purchase.
Because of course, you know, because when you're offered 828,000 square miles, you have to take it.
Where's that line? I mean, it's
no, of course. So no, as I always say, when this moment comes up in our programs, which it does every 6 weeks or so, if you are a purist, you don't want to hold power.
But we need to. I need to go back and make sure my justification was correct. I look at this as an original argument, an original question about what direction our nation took from that time to this.
Right. Well, see,
am I
no,
overstating
because
it?
This is, I mean, look, if these two men had never been born, this conversation would have had to happen. It wouldn't have been as cogently and brilliantly argued as it was by these two titans, Jefferson, the minimalist, and Hamilton, the flexible man. They're two of the greatest men who ever lived in the United States. They're extraordinarily talented writers and persuaders, and Washington turned to these two colossi, these two giants of American political thinking, and said, "All right, what's the right thing to do?" He didn't have to do that. He could have just either signed it or not signed it, but he turned to them, and they each wrote a classic. Jefferson's memo is a classic about minimalism and strict construction. It's one of the great things that Jefferson ever wrote, and he's right. Hamilton wrote a classic of flexibility. It may have some of the linearity issues that you're talking about, but it's still a classic. It's the basis of a broad and flexible, a living constitution, as we like to say. And this debate was going to happen with or without them, but they gave it this almost, you know, ancient Greek lucidity and classicism in the way that they expressed it. And that argument continues. But my point is we probably become a big, bloated, bureaucratic, flexible system no matter whether Hamilton and Jefferson ever lived, because that's just the that's the nature of countries. I mean, you can't point to any country on earth that doesn't have this problem, because suddenly new technologies emerge, new diseases appear, new demographics occur, there are world crises, and so you respond, and when you respond, you're basically laying down new tracks.
This has got to be a conversation that we continue in the future, because there's so much to be learned from both of these gentlemen, but I must thank President Jefferson for a fine conversation this week, and thank you as well, sir, but right now it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
which, by the way, is about Jefferson and judicial review, judicial activism, and so it's the same subject, more or less. President Trump has denounced the U.S. courts that have thwarted his political agenda, including his attempts to ban some Muslims from entering the United States. He has threatened to break up the Ninth Circuit, widely perceived to be too liberal, and he has complained about the decisions of what he calls so-called justices. Trump's rhetoric is extreme and perhaps irresponsible, but it is hardly unique. The judicial branch of the American government has annoyed or outraged American presidents from the beginning. When the Supreme Court declared in Worcester v. Georgia that the Cherokee Indians were a distinct nation-state that was entitled to considerable legal sovereignty, President Andrew Jackson, who was determined to remove the Cherokee to make room for white settlement, reportedly said, "John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it." Jackson ignored the court and pursued removal policies that led to the Trail of Tears. More than 100 years later, in 1958, President Eisenhower is reported to have said, "I have made two mistakes as president, and they are both sitting on the Supreme Court." He was referring to Chief Justice Earl Warren and Associate Justice William Brennan. FDR was so frustrated by the Supreme Court's habit of striking down his prized New Deal alphabetical legislation that he tried to pack the court by raising the number of justices from 9 to 12. The Constitution does not specify how many justices there must be. Still, FDR's scheme failed. The American people are very conservative about their Constitution. Not even the Great Depression, coupled with the enormous authority of FDR, could convince them to refashion the Supreme Court. FDR's fifth cousin, Theodore Roosevelt, was disgusted to see his progressive program hamstrung by the federal court system. By 1910, he was so frustrated that he proposed something called judicial recall, meaning that unpopular or unprogressive court decisions could be referred and overridden by a simple majority of the American people. This idea was so radical that it almost cost T.R. his closest friendship with Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. It may have cost him re-election in the notorious Bull Moose campaign of 1912. Our own hero, Thomas Jefferson, decried the Marshall Court's determination to read the United States Constitution in the broadest, boldest, most centralizing, and most capitalistic manner. Jefferson wanted a weak, literally interpreted Constitution, and he believed that states are usually more competent than the national government in protecting the rights of citizens. Jefferson spoke of Marshall's twistifications, his tortured legal metaphysics, and his deliberate distortion of the spirit of the United States Constitution. Jefferson was so upset by Marshall that he even resorted to ad hominem, accusing his distant cousin of having loose, lounging manners, and noting that Marshall frequented taverns. During the last hours of the discredited Adams administration, the Federalists packed the courts with Jefferson's sworn political enemies, including John Marshall, and just to make things harder for Jefferson, they reduced the number of Supreme Court seats from 6 to 5. That was designed to prevent Jefferson from naming any Supreme Court justices. Once he was safely in power, however, Jefferson convinced his Republican Congress to pass the Judiciary Act of 1802, which, among other things, punished Marshall and the other Supreme Court justices by making them ride circuit, that is, travel to districts far removed from the District of Columbia to hear cases as individual federal judges. Given the horrific travel logistics of the early national period, this was a clever, if petty, way of teaching Supreme Court justices humility. My point here is that presidents like the U.S. court system when it affirms their policies, and they find it frustrating or unbearable when the courts thwart their will. Sometimes, as with Barack Obama and Eisenhower, it is not much more than exasperated venting, but sometimes, as with FDR, T.R., and Andrew Jackson, it breaks out into defiance. In the end, the courts usually win. In 1974, Richard Nixon handed over the secret tapes that forced him to resign. Al Gore graciously accepted the 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court in 2000, even though it was a strictly partisan vote, and even though he was quite likely the actual winner of the presidential election. Roe v. Wade revolutionized the reproductive history of the United States, even though most legal commentators regard that 1973 decision as a public policy initiative founded on a rickety legal argument. Perhaps most important in the present context, the Trump administration has grumbled, but nevertheless accepted the United States court system's determination that his partial Muslim ban is unconstitutional. To which I say, thank God for separation of powers. As John Adams put it in a letter to the sage of Monticello, checks and balances, Jefferson, however you and your party may have ridiculed them, are our only security. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.